You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, talking about politics, especially with family, has become fraught over the last couple of years. We'll talk to a UW student and an author about how we can overcome those political divides.
First, Amazon recently wrapped up a year-long contest to choose the second location for its headquarters and a promise of 50,000 jobs. In the end, there were two winners, New York City and Crystal City, Virginia, which is just outside of Washington, D.C.
That came after applications from hundreds of cities that included offers of tax incentives and other perks, similar to Wisconsin's deal with tech manufacturer Foxconn that could cost the state over $4 billion.
According to the Brookings Institution, American cities and states spend about $45 and $90 billion each year on tax breaks and other financial incentives for private companies. In the wake of the Amazon contest, many are asking if the bidding wars for employers have gotten out of hand and if there's a better way to compete for jobs.
Henry Grabar is a staff writer for Slate. He's been covering this story. Henry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
The Amazon HQ2 contest has been a long time in the works. Can you briefly take us through how that process played out and some of the offers we saw cities put on the table?
Sure. So last fall, Jeff Bezos and Amazon announced that they would be opening a second headquarters, saying basically that they had outgrown Seattle, where the company has been based since it formed in the mid-1990s. And they asked cities and states to bid for the second headquarters. They said they didn't know where they wanted to go, and they got something like, I think, between 200 and 300 applications from cities and states in the United States and Canada. And some of the perks that were offered were really quite ridiculous. I mean, we're talking, first of all, about the level of subsidy that was offered. Maryland offered $8.5 billion. New Jersey offered something on that level. Philadelphia offered almost $6 billion. And then you had some sort of more kind of eccentric perks that were offered. For example, Atlanta offered a private car on the MARTA transit system for Amazon employees and a special lounge for executives at the Atlanta airport. So it was generally a kind of, I think, pretty embarrassing spectacle for America's mayors and governors as they, sort of groveled at the feet of the world's richest man to bring jobs to their towns, and the result was announced a couple weeks ago. Sort of leaked out that Amazon was in fact going to be opening two branch offices in New York and just outside of Washington D.C. in Arlington, Virginia.
And was that a surprise at all, Henry?
Well, I think that to begin with, we weren't really sure what Amazon wanted out of this competition. I think it's easy to look back in retrospect and say, well, they did what every other company does, which is they were expanding and they opened, rather than a second headquarters, they basically opened two large regional branch offices in the two cities with the largest number of tech workers in the United States, the nation's government, capital of government, and the nation's capital of finance. I mean, in some ways, it makes perfect sense. In other ways, I think there was some sense that maybe Amazon was looking for the biggest subsidy that they would receive, and that didn't end up being the case. And there was also some sense that maybe Amazon was looking to create a kind of company town or do some sort of, maybe revitalize a city that had experienced population or job loss, and they didn't do that either. But that was, there was plenty of speculation about that. So I don't know if, maybe Amazon knew from the start that they were going to come to New York and Washington, and they just needed to, stir up this competition to get some nice tax breaks out of it. But I'm not sure that they really had their minds made up when they announced this.
We're talking with Henry Grabar. He's a staff writer for Slate, and he's been covering the story of Amazon's search and decision for where they would put their second headquarters. It turns out that they are going to split that between New York City and Crystal City, Virginia. Henry, something we hear from public officials is that without public incentives like these that are offered, a state or a city will miss out on economic opportunity. But you write that that's not necessarily the case. What did you find when you crunched those numbers?
Well, I guess one thing to say is that I think everyone agrees that we would all be better off if this race to the bottom system didn't exist and cities and states weren't constantly undercutting each other and undermining their own systems of taxation to fund public services by sort of pleading with these companies and cutting them deals and announcing tax breaks and so on. That said, since that's not the world we live in, and the world we live in is one where cities and states are free to make the best offer that they can, officials like New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo say that if we don't offer subsidies, companies won't come. And there are a couple arguments against that. One, in the case of a relocation like Amazon's, is that Amazon wanted to come to New York anyway. They clearly didn't make a decision based on where the largest subsidy was, and that New York just didn't drive a hard enough bargain with the company. The second argument is that even though the subsidies are taken out of future Amazon tax revenue, which is to say we're cutting them a deal on the future taxes that they pay, we're not giving them money right off the bat, that wouldn't have been necessary because that labor and that land that go into that Amazon deal now would have wound up being used by some other company for something else. And it's just that it's very hard to predict who's going to form a company in the next 5 years. And so, you know, officials will say that a deal like Amazon was the only way to get this company. And maybe that's true, but that ignores the opportunity cost, which is what happens if instead, you know, we spend that construction grant on a scholarship program at the local university and the next Jeff Bezos winds up coming out of Queens College.
Looking at these incentive packages, we are certainly very aware of them recently here in Wisconsin with the package that was used to lure Taiwan's Foxconn to the state. Also, there's an effort in the legislature to provide incentives for Kimberly-Clark to keep a facility open here. Is it something that has been snowballing recently, or have these kind of incentives been around for a long time but just kind of maybe flying a little more under the radar?
They have been around for a long time. You know, from year to year, they tend to vary. Every so often, a mega deal like Foxconn will come along. But by and large, they occur on a much smaller scale. Like in New York, for example, which is the nation's leader in business subsidies, they tend to happen almost as of right. Like if a company, you know, all a company has to do is make a few visits to a few offices across the river in New Jersey, and then they can go to the governor and say, we'd like to, you know, we're thinking about moving to New Jersey. How can you sweeten the deal for us? And, you know, it's companies like the New York Times, and the New York Times isn't going to move to New Jersey. So to some extent, they've been around for a long time. We've also seen this with sports franchises, of course, which will threaten to move if they don't get a municipality or a county or a state to pay for their new stadium. I think what is changing primarily right now is not the number of incentives being doled out, but that they're becoming increasingly well-publicized and they're becoming increasingly unpopular. And so I think if you look at a deal, you know, we now have a longer record of incentives to rely on when economists say that these are not effective economic development policies. So that research is being built on a better foundation. And I think that the public is also getting a little bit tired of these deals. I think it comes at a time when, you know, a few months after this enormous corporate tax cut, where people feel like, wait a second, why should we be giving this multinational corporation a big break?
Well, and at a recent demonstration in New York City against the Amazon deal, City Council member Jimmy Van Bramer spoke to the crowd, and here's a listen.
We have a public housing crisis. Just this morning, several residents contacted us to say there's no heat in Queensbridge. But somehow, folks who consider themselves progressive Democrats have seen fit to throw $3 billion at the richest man in the world.
And you covered that rally, Henry. What else did you hear from people opposing the deal?
There was a lot of rhetoric like that. I think, you know, in the case of New York, I think it also reflects the fact that a lot of these councilmen and state senators were left out of the negotiating room. And so to some extent, they just feel a little bitter, I think, that they weren't the ones involved. As I said, New York State has been giving out subsidies for businesses for everything for decades. And while, you know, reporters sometimes make a fuss about it, politicians generally have not. So I think that that was partly what was reflected there. But I also think that, you know, they have a point. When you look at the subsidies that New York gave out compared to the subsidies Virginia gave out, there's a sense that New York made a more generous offer. And I think New Yorkers, New York politicians who think of their city as one of the highest taxed places in the nation, and those high taxes go to pay for excellent public services and public amenities that wind up luring in companies like Amazon, they look at New York giving more generous subsidies than Virginia, and they say, this was not a good deal for the state. And obviously it comes at a time when New York is, on the one hand, sort of at the peak of its power, record employment, record population, and on the other, at a time when in New York, and I think in America in general, the widening inequality between the haves and the have-nots is increasingly visible, and it draws deals like this into the spotlight. And I think politicians see this as symbolic of larger issues in American society. And so even if initially polls like Jimmy Van Bramer were in favor of bringing Amazon to Long Island City, now that the deal has been announced, they're looking at it a little differently and seeing it maybe as an opportunity to make a point about what we offer to corporations versus what we offer to local mom and pop businesses or to the taxpayers themselves.
We're talking with Henry Grabar right now, a staff writer for Slate, and we're looking back at the Amazon HQ2 contest and the offers of tax incentives that came in from hundreds of cities.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think luring jobs with public money is a good idea? Do you think Wisconsin's deal with tech manufacturer Foxconn will ultimately pay off? Will it set a precedent for more companies to look for similar agreements? And if you are concerned, do you think there should be ways of preventing bidding wars for jobs in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're picking up our talk right now with Henry Grabar, staff writer at Slate. We're talking about the value of public incentives for private companies in the wake of Amazon's HQ2 contest.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of using tax money to convince a private company to relocate or stay in your area? Is it a useful tool or something cities and states should avoid offering? How do you think Wisconsin's deal with Foxconn will play out? And do you think there's a better way to attract jobs from big companies? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@WPR.org. And Henry, one of the arguments for spending the money to attract these big companies is that they create spin-off development, so jobs and businesses to support something like Foxconn or Amazon and its employees. Are those advantages something that should be considered when deciding whether these incentive packages are worth it?
Oh, definitely. I think that for tech jobs in particular, there's a sense that there's a very, very high multiplier effect. And that for every, you know, I think the Berkeley economist Enrico Moretti, who's written this book, The Geography of Jobs, and he talks about the multiplier effect from tech jobs, and he estimates that each new tech job ultimately creates five more outside the tech industry in the long run. And so that's a case where, I'll tell you, every government economic development official knows this. And this is the logic that they're using when they offer those subsidies, because they think so much is going to come through. But there's a lot of problems with the system generally. One, states and cities get outmaneuvered by savvy companies. Two, so they make, you know, bad offers. Two, even if the offer is decent, the companies don't follow through. And I know that's been an issue for Foxconn with some of their other deals, but it's been an issue for subsidies across the board where you know, a sports team or company will relocate and they'll say they're creating X number of jobs, and it turns out the jobs don't pay that much, and some of the employees wind up coming from overseas and don't actually live in the state, and so it doesn't end up working out the way you hope. And then the last thing, I guess, is just saying that, you know, a subsidy is not necessarily the most efficient way to attract those jobs. So, you know, given that we want tech jobs and we want high-paying jobs, and I would say that, you know, actually that's, in some communities, that's not even a given. But let's assume that. You could argue that spending that money on a new computer science lab at the local university would, in the long run, produce a larger cluster of homegrown talent and potentially a more organic system that wouldn't be dependent on these kinds of offers and these kinds of, competitions to lure in outside companies. So those would be the arguments against it. But you're right that would be the logic that the economic development officials would use to justify this kind of plan.
Let's go to the phones, and Cindy in Appleton is up first. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Well, I would think these tax credits are basically stealing from our education system, and I think an educated populace or educated public is, you know, where your workers come from. That should be what attracts these kind of companies, and I think a quality of life is also an issue that should attract these companies, and accessibility by highways and the road systems and et cetera, et cetera. It shouldn't be about tax credits. It should be about what they get when they get here.
Thanks for that call, Cindy. And Henry, that was something I was wondering about. When companies are weighing where they might want to go, how do they rank those things? Because they can get a great tax incentive, but if there isn't the infrastructure there, or if there isn't a guarantee of qualified workers, is there any incentive big enough to get them there?
No, there's not. Companies, it turns out, are not as responsive to tax regimes as politicians think they are. Neither, for that matter, are rich people. It turns out that both people and companies locate where they think they're going to thrive, and that depends on quality of life and the local labor pool and the infrastructure and all sorts of other things. But often the local tax structure is not the biggest factor, and I think Amazon is really the best proof of that we've seen, because the company located in two of the nation's most expensive housing markets, where they're going to have to pay higher wages to compete, where their workers are going to have to spend more on housing, and they located in the places that offered, relatively speaking, a fairly small subsidy, especially when you compare to places like, you know, Philadelphia or Montgomery County, Maryland. And those are not, you know, we're not talking about locating, you know, in western Nebraska or something like that. You know, Philadelphia is a big city with a small tech sector, and it's just down the road from New York and not far from Washington either. So if anything, I think that Cindy's point is proven by this Amazon decision, which is that they decided to go to the place where they felt they were going to find the most talented workers.
Let's go back to the phones, and John in Green Bay is up. Hi, John.
Hi there. So a couple points. The same people who always want government out of their lives turn around and are right there asking government to get them, give them a boost in business, and that's pretty frustrating. But my other point is, what if you looked at it more like, I have $1 billion and I'm going to invest that $1 billion. What would make more sense? Putting it in one stock of one company that might even have a little bit of a sketchy history in the Foxconn situation? Or what if you took that $1 billion and gave 1,000 companies who have a rock-solid business model and a track record of growth, if you gave them each $1 million and said, you know, have at it? To me, a diversified investment makes a little more sense. And I just think it's, and then otherwise they get too big to fail, And there's no way we're going to ever back out of this deal once we're that much, you know, committed that much.
Thanks for that, John. So, Henry, an idea of spreading the wealth quite literally and maybe investing in some local up-and-coming businesses.
Yeah, I think John's idea is a really good one. And one of the reasons that we don't see that happen more often is because politicians want to have a newspaper headline. They want to cut a ribbon. They want to get the kind of attention that Scott Walker got in Wisconsin and with President Trump, and that Andrew Cuomo has gotten in New York with this Amazon deal. And to them, it feels like, you know, it's almost like, you know, you just, it's a one-stop shop for getting all these jobs. And the price in many cases is passed down throughout the year. So in the case of Amazon, for example, the subsidies are coming out of state tax revenue 6, 8, 10 years in the future. And so in reality, the line item on the state budget right now is nothing. So I think that is the, you know, that's what they see, and it looks good to them. But I agree ultimately that a more diversified economy, one with smaller homegrown businesses, one that provides opportunities for entrepreneurs, workforce training programs. I mean, I think but the research shows that is probably the more sustainable economic model than going from mega deal to mega deal, forfeiting future tax revenue.
And Henry, briefly, because we need to wrap up, it feels, sitting here talking with you, like this is kind of like an arms race. Even if participants don't want to keep upping the ante, they also don't feel like they can safely be the ones to pull back. Briefly, is there anything that's going to stop this level of competition on incentives?
Yeah, I think that the best chance is that people get loud enough and upset enough about the deals that are being made, and they say, we don't want to do this anymore. I think the most optimistic signs that I've seen come from local metro areas where various counties and cities in one place, so like in the Denver metro area in Colorado or in the Phoenix metro area in Arizona, are saying to each other, all right, let's all basically agree that we're not going to try and steal companies from across the county line or the city line or whatever it is. And that's
And we're going to have to leave it there. Henry, thanks so much for joining us. Henry Grabar joined us to talk about incentives for companies to move to a community. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, being childless doesn't mean that you can't leave your mark. Host John Munson and his guests look at how people without children can leave a legacy after they're gone. That's tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, according to Pew Research, over the last 2 years, people on both sides of the political aisle have reported higher levels of stress when discussing politics with people they don't agree with.
It's especially true among Democrats, though Republicans reported a slight uptick in levels of stress as well.
And while political disagreements are nothing new, increasing polarization has made these conversations feel particularly fraught and for some insurmountable.
In a minute, we'll chat with the author of the book Talking Across the Divide about how we can reach across divisions to find common ground, and that these conversations, while perhaps not easy, are both possible and necessary.
But first, a student group at the University of Wisconsin-Madison is trying to bring students of all political stripes together in order to foster dialogue on campus. Anna Berry is the president of the Political Science Student Association. Anna, thanks for joining us.
Of course. I'm happy to be here.
So why did you and your fellow group members want to start the Political Science Student Association?
So essentially, the political science department wanted to get some sort of organization that was like a professional development organization, because our department didn't really have anything like that, where lots of other departments do. So the department was really like the founder. They got everything moving on off the ground because they started the peer mentor program and the peer mentors led it. But then ultimately they set up this meeting and they had, you know, anybody who was interested come, and then you run for your positions. And that's how it all started.
So one of the big conversations happening on campuses right now is what feels like students at loggerheads, maybe not agreeing on certain political issues, maybe not even engaging with people who have differing viewpoints. You know, one of the goals, it seems, of your organization is that you are trying to at least bridge that gap somewhat. You know, how successful has that been so far?
I definitely would deem a lot of the things we've done a success. The biggest success, I think the first step we had in getting really recognized would be last semester we hosted a gun control debate. And obviously that's always a hot topic, mm-hmm. especially that was very soon after the Parkland shooting. Mm-hmm. And we had students from, you know, Young Americans for Freedom, Young Americans for Liberty, college Democrats, college Republicans, and even the International Socialists. So we really tried to get a really diverse group of people because so many people are always like, oh, it's always the, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans. Mm-hmm. But there's so much more than that on our campus. So we brought them all together for a panel and I had to moderate it. It did get a little heated, but all together, it was really a good time. And at the end, you know, some of the libertarians started agreeing with the socialists, and I was just blown away by that.
Yeah, so it's really interesting that that's kind of the case study that you and your organization and your fellow members have, is something that's really a very hot button issue. Did you find, you know, from that or even other political conversations that there is common ground between you and your fellow students?
Oh, there definitely is. It's just always a surprise to people. People never realize, oh, wait, you feel the same way I do about that? So I really think it's about, you know, of course, bridging that divide and starting dialogue on these conversations. And luckily, we've been a really great platform for that because lots of other students try to start these conversations in areas where it can be deemed, you know, a little harder to have these conversations, like through ASM, our student organization, our government, our student government. And nothing really plays out there. You know, it's not really anything that's going to bridge anything that's going to start conversations. It's usually just like, here's one side, here's the other, that's it. But there's more than just two sides, too. Like I said, there's so many, like those third-party groups that I mentioned, they never get any coverage on campus. They were so thankful that we reached out to them and wanted to hear their opinions.
What do you think some of the long-term goals of your organization will be?
Essentially, we were supposed to be a professional development group altogether, which we definitely are. We have lots of networking events all the time with really notable alumni who come from all sides of the aisle, which is, again, something so cool that we get to have is, you know, we have somebody who started working in oil, like for like ExxonMobil. And then now he's part of the Ocean Conservation Group and he's an alumni. And he talked about his transition and how, you know, something like that changes. But that's, you know, that happens so often for so many different people. So for the future of our group, I really see more of a place for dialogue and more of an open forum and an invite to people that aren't just political science majors.
Well, Anna, we'll have to leave it there for right now, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, I'm so happy to be here.
Anna Berry is a student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the president of the Political Science Student Association. She joined us to talk about how she and her fellow students are looking to bridge the political divide in order to have more productive political conversations.
Now, our next guest has dedicated much of his life to finding ways for people of opposing viewpoints to have honest and open conversations with the goal of finding common ground.
Justin Lee is the author of Talking Across the Divide, How to Communicate with People You Disagree With and Maybe Even Change the World. Justin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So this is not the first book you've written where you talk about, you know, bridging these divides. How did you get to this being a passion of yours?
Well, I grew up in a conservative Southern Baptist home and had a lot of views about cultural issues and political issues and all of that in that context. And one of the issues that I cared about was homosexuality. I believed that being gay was a sin and a choice, and it was an issue I was fairly outspoken about. And then as I got older, I came to realize that I was gay, which sort of threw everything, turned everything upside down for me in my life. And as I started sharing my story, I found that there were a lot of other folks on that particular issue who were really struggling, folks who were gay or LGBTQ Christians, folks who were Christians who had a conservative view but had good friends or family members who were gay or LGBTQ, folks on all sides who just felt like we could have this conversation in a better way. And so I've spent the last 20 years of my life, having conversations with folks on all sides of that conversation. And I wrote a book called Torn, Rescuing the Gospel from the Gays versus Christians Debate, about that subject. But as I've been having that conversation more and more, I've discovered that my friends on all sides of that topic are also on different sides of a lot of other issues. And I've become really interested in how polarized we are as a country, and how do we move forward without letting that polarization tear us apart?
Yeah, there have been a lot of conversations about political polarization in the United States. It's not anything new, but it feels as though it has become, I guess, more concrete, more solidified in the past few years. And there are plenty of reasons why we might have gotten to this spot, but you've written a little bit about what you think might be at issue. You know, what are you seeing as some of the things that are exacerbating political polarization?
Well, I think one of the things is the growth of the internet and how much time we spend on the internet and on social media, and particularly getting our news there. One of the things, there have been other books written about this, most notably a book called The Filter Bubble a few years ago. One of the things that's happened is that sites like Facebook are designed with algorithms that tell us what we want to hear so that they will keep us there. So when I go on Facebook, if I have friends on the left and on the right, and most of us tend to have friends on Facebook who are most like ourselves, but say if I have friends who are a broad cross-section of the American populace, if I tend to click on the articles that my friends post on the right and don't click on the articles that lean left, I'm going to see more and more of those articles that lean right. That's what Facebook's going to show me. And if I never click on the articles that lean right, then Facebook's going to stop showing them to me. And so gradually what happens is these computer algorithms on Facebook, on Google, and everywhere else we go online start to show us more and more of the content that we already like. And we get into these bubbles where we're only talking to the people who think like us and only seeing information that reflects back to us what we already believe. And so gradually the other side of whatever issue seems to make less and less sense to us as time goes on, to the point that we're not even operating in the same reality. We're not hearing the same facts. We're not hearing the same positions. And so we just don't understand each other, and we don't know how to talk to each other.
Yeah, it sort of seems as though people become one-dimensional when we get to these disagreements, and it makes it sometimes easier to either demonize people we disagree with or completely write them off. Do you think that that has been made easier because of the internet, that we can simply shut people out?
Absolutely. So if you and I communicate primarily on Facebook and we disagree strongly on an issue that I care about, it's really easy for me to just block you, and all of a sudden you're gone, and I don't have to listen to you anymore, and I don't have to consider your position anymore. And I do think there are times in our lives where someone is just toxic and you have to take time away from them, or maybe even cut them out of your life altogether. But it's gotten so easy for us to do that all the time, anytime somebody challenges us, that we do get more and more into these bubbles of like-minded folks from around the world. And, you know, there's not, when I can easily communicate with people all over the world who agree with me, there's not as much incentive for me to try to work things out with my local friends and family members who disagree with me, because I can always find somebody else who will be my new Facebook friend. So I do think that's a real problem. And it's something that we've got to fight, as hard as that may be, because if we continue down this trajectory, we're really in trouble as a nation.
We're talking to Justin Lee right now. He is the author of Talking Across the Divide, How to Communicate with People You Disagree With, and Maybe Even Change the World. So, you know, the crux of this whole conversation is that there are people that you do not agree with, but you know that there is a place for dialogue. So just at the beginning, how do you get the ball rolling when, you know, some people simply don't want to engage?
Well, there are several reasons. I talk about five barriers in my book that are usually the reason that's underlying why somebody doesn't want to talk to you or doesn't seem to listen. But one of the first things that you can do that will knock down, at least make progress on knocking down some of those barriers, is something that we very rarely do because it feels a bit counterintuitive, and that is to listen. We often think that the best weapon that we have to get someone to see our point of view is our ability to argue. But arguments very rarely change minds in a one-on-one kind of context. When you just argue with each other, just debate with each other, it tends to cause people to dig in their heels more. Whereas when you listen to somebody, even if you don't feel that it's fair, even if you feel that they should be listening to you by all rights, and perhaps they should, when you listen to them, it helps calm them down. If you can reflect back to them what you've heard from them and help them see that you do understand their side of things, that helps to put them in a position of being ready to listen to you. But also, as you listen, you learn more about what's their real motivation. What's the motivation behind the motivation? What is it that really is important to them about whatever this issue is that you're discussing? And that's something you can use then to advance the conversation.
Justin, I want to get back to listening in just a second, but I want to remind our listeners that we're talking to Justin Lee right now. He's the author of Talking Across the Divide, How to Communicate with People You Disagree With and Maybe Even Change the World. And he's with us to talk about how we can have difficult political conversations with people we disagree with and how we can make those seemingly fraught interactions more productive.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of political polarization? Is it new or has it been around for as long as politics have? How do you have conversations about politics with friends or family, or do you avoid the conversations altogether? And do you think it's possible to disagree about politics but have a meaningful conversation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
And we'll continue this conversation after a quick break here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we continue our conversation about why having conversations with people you disagree with can be so difficult, but why, in an age of polarization, having these conversations is more important than ever. Our guest is Justin Lee. He's the author of Talking Across the Divide, How to Communicate with People You Disagree With and Maybe Even Change the World.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you think people should be talking about politics? Do you find political conversations to be stressful? And if so, how do you approach them? Or maybe you even avoid them. And do you think that there is a way to reduce political polarization? You can call in right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Justin, before we went to that break, we were talking about the importance of listening, and I know that that's pretty central to your argument here. How do you recommend, given that I think we are an argumentative people at times, to be a more engaged listener?
Well, one of the things I think that you can always listen for is, how would the person you're talking to tell the story of their own position, their own involvement with whatever the issue is that you're discussing? Very often we go into these conversations assuming that the other person is either an idiot or a villain. But the reality is, nobody or almost nobody goes through life seeing themselves as an idiot or a villain. And so even if you think that the other person's position is villainous in some way, they aren't going through life going, I am evil and I'm going to do all the evil things, you know. And so what we have to do is listen well enough that we can share back to this person the story as they would tell it, with them as the protagonist. Because if you can do that, even if you think that they're not the protagonist, if you can tell the story back to them in a way that paints them in a positive light, then they feel heard and they feel understood. And then they're ready to hear you tell a different story, which is the story of your own involvement with the issue and why you care about it and hope that they'll change their mind.
I want to go to our callers really quickly. We have Richard in Madison. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Here is my view on this. Now, I've been watching the postmodern era, also known as the era of subjectivity, emerge since the mid-80s. And in the 90s, I watched our society become increasingly polarized, especially as we went through the 90s. So what we're talking about now is nothing new. It's just become quite extreme. So I have seen not only a correlation of subjective thought and polarization, but I believe it's cause and effect. I do not believe that this polarization is caused by the echo chamber of peer groups, the internet, Google, whatever. But that is the effect.
Richard, thank you so much for that call. So Richard is saying that, you know, there was this emergence of a more subjective conversation versus facts. When you've been working with this, have you found that there might be a balance between those, you know, the anecdotes from people where you are, you know, relating to people a little bit more and when you can bring out some facts?
Yeah, I think that facts are important. Some things are true and some things aren't. And one of the pushbacks I often get from folks when I talk about the importance of listening and the importance of dialogue is people think that I'm saying, oh, nobody's right, everybody's got a right to their own opinion, and you know, who's to say who's right? Well, I don't think that's true. I think there are rights and wrongs. I think there are facts and then there are, you know, false facts. But I, because of the world that we live in, which so sometimes people do view things in a very subjective way, it's important to understand what someone believes to be true, even if they're wrong. Because if somebody's not operating with the facts, then they're seeing the world from a completely different perspective. They think that the options are different or the situation is different than it actually is. And that's important for you to know if you're going to have any hope of getting through to them.
I want to go back to our callers. We have Jenny in Milwaukee. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I was just very intrigued by the show today, and I am a practitioner and a trainer in the deliberative dialogue practices, and we're currently working with high school students in Milwaukee discussing what it is about their community that concerns them, and then drawing parallels of like how to solve these wicked problems that the adults aren't solving. Mm-hmm. And we found with adults and the youth that it's like so important for us to just try to get on the same page about the types of things that are concerning them or the adults, so we can see where there's commonalities and places where they can work together towards a solution. And we found over the course of doing this that students just like they're craving to have a real conversation. The adults are craving to have a real conversation where we're really looking at issues from multiple sides and looking for those places of understanding.
And Jenny, thank you for that call. You know, Justin, what do you have to say to that?
Well, I think that it's this kind of dialogue is so valuable. And I think that any way that people can have it, whether it's in a group setting, one-on-one, the more of these kinds of dialogues that we can have, the better off we are. In my book, Talking Across the Divide, I talk about some of the dialogues that I've helped to host on the subject of sexuality and faith, since that's my background, and how people often who you don't expect to see eye to eye end up coming to not necessarily agree with each other, but coming to a lot more common ground than you'd think just by sharing their stories, listening to each other, and asking good questions.
Now, we don't have a ton of time left, but I, you know, part of when we do engage in dialogue, sometimes people view it as an argument and that it's a zero-sum game that they need to win in order to prove their point. But, you know, you don't necessarily take that stance, but how do you, in your practice, challenge people and help them break out of that mindset?
Well, ultimately, I think what we all need is to know what is true and to be able to find ways to move forward in a way that's beneficial to all of us. If very often we're operating based on different sets of information, different facts, different understandings of the world. And as we talk to each other and listen to each other, we can at least get closer together and at least understand what's motivating one another, which does enable us to find solutions that are mutually beneficial, even if we don't continue, even if we continue to disagree. But often agreement can come out of these conversations, given time and given people's willingness to put their egos aside and listen. And, you know, ultimately, if we can go forward in a way that at least we're having better conversations, I think that's better for us as a society.
Well, Justin, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. And your listeners can follow up with me on these conversations on my website at geekyjustin.com, GEEKY Justin.com. Thanks so much.
Justin Lee is the author of Talking Across the Divide, How to Communicate with People You Disagree With and Maybe Even Change the World. This is Central Time.
Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow after 6:20, host John Munson and his guests talk about why it's important for children to see characters that look like them in books. They'll discuss how representation can shape kids' sense of themselves and of what they can accomplish. That's tomorrow morning after 6:20, right here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we hear how women's anger has been and continues to be a key component to progress in the social and political movements. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. This is Central Time.